Hi, this is Ruth McCauley with news from the Decatur area for Thursday, March 3rd. We begin with some crime and courts items written by Huey Freeman from Decatur. Decatur woman's beating death ruled a homicide. The death of 38-year-old Jacqueline Green, who was found unresponsive after a physical fight with her boyfriend's twin brother, has been ruled a homicide by a coroner's jury. New details about the circumstances surrounding the death of the Decatur woman were revealed at the inquest held Wednesday morning in the office of Macon County Coroner Michael E. Day. Members of a group that included Brian E. Brummett, 30, his twin brother, and Jacqueline Green purchased alcohol the night of February 13th to have a party to celebrate Valentine's Day, Decatur Police Detective Jason Kutchelmeister testified. The party was held at the house where Green resided with the two brothers in the 2300 block of East Finch Street. When they returned from the store, quote, everyone consumed alcoholic beverages and everyone became intoxicated, end quote, Kulturmeister said. Green and her boyfriend's twin brother became involved in a physical altercation. He hit her in the face several times. At some point, she passed out. When the others woke up the next day at about 11 a.m., she was found unresponsive, face down on the floor of a room that contained computers. Kutchelmeister said Green's boyfriend's brother admitted to police that he struck Green during an altercation. Brian Brummett, 30, was arrested February 15th and arraigned Friday on felony counts of involuntary manslaughter and aggravated domestic battery. He is being held in the Macon County Jail on $1 million bond. If convicted of involuntary manslaughter, Brummett is facing between 3 and 7 years in prison. Kutchelmeister said there was a considerable size disparity between Brummett and Green. He is 5'9", weighing 300 pounds. She was 5'4", and weighed much less. During the altercation, her boyfriend tried to separate his brother from Green, Kutchelmeister said. At one point, she remained in one room while her boyfriend's brother went to another room. The police investigation found that no weapons were involved. Autopsy results showed that Green died of a subdural hematoma, a brain bleed, resulting from blunt trauma to the head, Day told jurors. She also suffered facial bruises, as well as multiple bruises to the top of her shoulders, arms, left hand, knuckles, and right side of her abdomen. All those injuries appeared to be recent and consistent with some kind of physical attack or altercation. Kutchelmeister said the police are continuing to investigate the incident. Brummett is due in court to present his attorney on March 11th. Inquest reveals Tarek DeWalt shot at close range. At the coroner's inquest into the death of 21-year-old Tarek DeWalt, a police detective revealed new details of the city's first homicide of the year. DeWalt was shot at close range within an arm's reach of the shooter, said Decatur Police Detective Brad Hall at the inquest, at which jurors ruled his death as a homicide. A resident of the 800 block of East Main Street, DeWalt was visiting the apartment building at 1440 East Wellington Way the night of January 13th. Police received reports of shots fired with a person down in the parking lot. Patrol officers and detectives were sent to the scene to investigate. The victim received one gunshot wound to the chest area. He was transported to Decatur Memorial Hospital, where he was pronounced dead. Hall testified that the victim had been engaged in a struggle with another person. During the struggle, he was shot one time, Hall said. DeWalt was not armed. The shooter, later identified as 18-year-old Cherise Hendricks, brought the firearm firearm to the crime scene and had control of it during the shooting, Hall said. There were no other firearms or other people involved. Did anyone observe any or all of this incident? Asked Macon County Coroner Michael E. Day. Yes, some of it, Hall said. After an intensive police investigation, Hendricks was arrested early the morning of January 22nd. He was arraigned January 29th on four counts of first-degree murder with a firearm enhancement. If convicted, he is facing 45 years to life in prison. Hendricks, who entered a not guilty plea, is represented by an assistant public defender. He is serving a 24-month probation term as a result of a guilty plea in October to a felony charge of unlawful use of a weapon. He is due in court for a pretrial hearing in the murder case on March 15th. We turn now to the front page of the Decatur Herald and Review and pick up a story out of Springfield by an AP writer, Associated Press writer Ivan Moreno, somewhat related to the crimes we just heard about. Law enforcement urge end to budget standoff. Prosecutors and law enforcement officials criticized Illinois lawmakers and Republican Governor Bruce Rauner on Wednesday for failing to pass a state budget, saying their nine-month standoff is hurting public safety. State's attorneys, sheriffs, and police chiefs focused their comments on youth crime diversion programs that are serving fewer teens because they haven't gotten state funding since July 1st, when the current year budget should have taken effect. Law enforcement officials argued that lack of funding for those programs will hurt the state in the long term. More than half of the state's counties that participate in Redeploy Illinois, which provides counseling to teens at a risk of incarceration, have left the program, affecting almost 300 youths who would have been served, according to a survey by Fight Crime, Invest in Kids. The survey also found that about 1,800 youths no longer have access to after-school programs, and that community-based centers that help runaways have cut staff. There is no doubt that the failure to provide these services is a tremendous burden on our courtrooms, on our police, and ultimately on society, said Tyler Edmonds, the state's attorney for Union County. His comments came just before Rauner discussed parts of his plan to overhaul the state's criminal justice system, designed to reduce the state's prison population by 25% by 2025. The governor's plan has bipartisan support, even as Rauner and Democrats who control the legislature have been unable to reach a deal on the state budget. Rauner promoted three pieces of legislation he said will help improve public safety while reducing incarceration rates and helping offenders return to society. One bill would direct prosecutors to explain why someone without a prior criminal record needs to be incarcerated and require a pre-sentencing report in such instances. Another measure would increase the use of electronic monitoring as an alternative to prison. The third proposal requires prison officials and the Secretary of State to provide identification cards to offenders upon their release to help with their transition back to society. Today is an important and very positive step forward to benefit the people of Illinois, Rauner said. The proposals came out of a panel he formed to recommend changes to how the state deals with offenders. One member of the panel, St. Clair County State's Attorney Brendan Kelly, commended Rauner's goal during the news conference with other law enforcement officials, but said it's undermined by the budget crisis. Criminal justice reform, it's not just the right thing to do, it's a smart thing to do, and we all understand that, he said. It reduces crime. But we need to move forward. We need to move forward with that criminal justice reform and this budget impasse. We're not moving forward. We're moving the exact opposite direction. Rauner said it's a tragedy that the state still lacks a budget, but added that the criminal justice system has been broken in Illinois for decades. He said the failure to pass balanced budgets and policies that grow the economy are partly to blame. Because we haven't had balanced budgets, businesses leave, we lose jobs, people become unemployed, crime goes up. Human service needs go up because we're not growing our economy, he said. Rauner has repeatedly said he wants to make the state more business-friendly, in part by passing legislation to curb the power of unions and reduce business costs. His suggestions have not been well received by Democrats. Oh, that's a wonderful sentence. Very, very understated. His suggestions have not been well received by Democrats. More on the state budget, written by Dan Petrella, who's an H&R Springfield bureau chief. Illinois House unable to override MAP grant veto. Hours after the Illinois House failed to override Republican Governor Bruce Rauner's veto of a higher education funding bill, the chamber's Democratic leader announced a new plan to fund universities, community colleges, and grants to low-income students, along with several human services programs. The House will be asked Thursday, that's today, to consider a bill that would fund the programs at the same levels as the General Assembly approved in May, said Steve Brown, a spokesman for House Speaker Michael Madigan, a Democrat of Chicago. That funding is tied to another measure that would do away with a requirement that the state repay within 18 months about $450 million that was borrowed from special funds to plug holes in last year's budget. Funding for higher education and some human services has been caught up in a deadlock between Rauner and Democratic leaders in the legislature, now in its ninth month. Brown called the plan announced Wednesday evening a new compromise effort that contains an agreed funding source, end quote. The bill Rauner vetoed would have spent $721.5 million on grants for low-income students through the Monetary Award Program and operations at community colleges. Republicans in the House and Senate, none of whom voted to buck the governor, criticized the Democratic-backed bill because they said there was no way to pay for it. State Representative Terry Bryant, a Republican of Murfreesboro, who represents Southern Illinois University at Carbondale, called it a hoax. "It's a lie," Bryant said. "It's smoke and mirrors." State Representative Dan Brady, a Republican of Bloomington, who represents Illinois State University, likened it to trying to save someone who's drowning. "You throw that person a life jacket, but you wouldn't throw them a life jacket that had no material in it to keep them and the jacket afloat," Brady said. They and other Republicans argued that lawmakers should consider proposals they've made, which they said include funding for public universities and ways to pay the associated expenses. One GOP-backed proposal, which Rauner expressed support for earlier this week, would free up money for emergency funding to universities and community colleges by doing away with the special fund repayment requirement. Noting the Rauner's support for the concept, Brown said, "We'll try to meet the governor part way." Earlier in the day, State Representative Kelly Burke, a Democrat of Evergreen Park, the vetoed bill's House sponsor, argued that funding MAP grants and community colleges was a good first step toward funding the entire higher education system. "I hear some concerns from the other side that somehow this is bad for taxpayers," Burke said. "I'll tell you what's bad for taxpayers: closing universities, shutting down the higher education system, limiting access to universities. Students are taxpayers. The folks who work at universities are taxpayers. The people who live in towns that are supported by institutions such as Carbondale, DeKalb, Macomb, Charleston, Champaign, Urbana, Chicago, University Park, Bloomington, those folks are taxpayers too. And when their biggest economic engine in those areas goes down or suffers because of the crippling effect of our inaction, we're going to hear from them. Whoa, that's a mouthful. Ultimately, the House fell 2 votes short of overriding Rauner's veto, with State Representative Scott Drury, a Democrat of Highwood, voting against the proposal, and State Representative Luis Arroyo, Democrat of Chicago, absent. That followed a successful override veto in the Senate. After the House vote, Rauner's office praised Republican lawmakers and Drury for standing up for taxpayers today. Despite the governor's request that the General Assembly not waste time with a political vote that was never going to pass, the legislature is poised to leave students, universities, and community colleges in the lurch for at least a month. Spokeswoman Catherine Kelly said, "We continue to urge Democratic leaders not to recess until the General Assembly passes a bipartisan proposal to fund MAP grants and higher education." With primaries coming March 15th, the House is scheduled to leave town after Thursday's session and not reconvene until April. In local news, an article written by Allison Petty, who's an H&R staff writer, Park District continues to contemplate drone rules. Options for regulating the use of drones in local parks will likely come before the Decatur Park District Board soon. Executive Director Bill Clevenger said Wednesday that district staff members are still reviewing options for a policy related to the drones, otherwise known as unmanned aerial vehicles. He expected discussion to continue later in March or early April at the latest. "That's uncharted waters for a lot of agencies," Clevenger said. "We're all trying to determine what we're going to do and how we're going to address drones at events, for example. There are safety issues involved in this." The board first heard about the issue in November, when Park Police Chief Ed Culp raised concerns about possible criminal use and the potential for liability if someone in the parks were injured by a drone. Vice President Bob Brilley II asked for a status update Wednesday, sparking some discussion from commissioners. They wondered whether to ban drones entirely, permit their use only in certain areas, or create an application process to allow for them in specific instances. "It's a new area that's just emerged, and the popularity of drones has been off the charts," Clevenger said. "Now we have to figure out how to control the use and how to make the use appropriate, and then given all the different layers, how do those all interface with each other?" Ed Booth, the district's attorney, said the district might benefit from waiting to see how other agencies and government bodies handle the issue, which is evolving. "Sometimes it's good to be a follower," he said. Commissioner Chris Harrison said he liked the idea of creating an area where drones would be allowed, with signs that would notify people to enter at their own risk. "As much as there are predatory concerns and safety concerns, there's also kids that saved up $200 to do it, and there's nowhere to fly them," he said. Board President Jack Kenny said drone users should have thought about that before making the purchase. "But they're out there," Harrison replied. "You can't put the jack back in the box." New director promises new direction for Dove, an article written by Teresa Churchill, an H&R senior writer. With the introduction of a new executive director at a news conference Wednesday, Dove Incorporated served notice that a new chapter of service to the community is on the way. Christine Gregory, who officially started work on Tuesday, said her agency will be moving out of a period of simply fighting to maintain the services it offers to one of reaching out to meet unmet needs. "What I bring According to Dove, is this renewed sense that we have hope and reason to dream big one more time, Gregory said. One goal is to reduce our reliance on state funding and going to local funds to the best of our ability. The ongoing state budget crisis forced Dove to shut down its community services program in August after closing its community recycling center 2 months earlier because it was no longer making money. Gregory said for the past month she and her leadership team have been looking at new grant opportunities and new partnerships to pursue. She also took the opportunity to talk about Dove's upcoming events, including domestic violence education and volunteer training in April, and ongoing support for Homeward Bound from people who present a flyer available on the agency's website when they dine at Bob Evans on the 20th of every month. We are going to be spending our time seeking input and focusing our energy on developing a strategic plan for how we go forward, she said. Over the next few months, you can plan to see me in the community just about everywhere. Gregory, who is 41 and lives with her family in Moroa, is phasing out her work this semester as digital learning support lead for the State of Illinois Virtual School and teaching organic chemistry at Millikan University. A member of St. John's Episcopal Church, she is also a new postulant studying to become an ordained vocational deacon. We're taking a look over at the Decatur Tribune online and picking up Paul Osborne's City Beat column, Citizen Wants Review of Downtown Handicapped Parking. Betty Wheatley dropped a letter by our newspaper office last week that she had mailed to the City of Decatur offices on January 30th. Since she hadn't received a reply in a month, Betty wanted to make her appeal for a review of downtown handicapped parking known to our readers. She wrote, "Perhaps the downtown handicapped parking spaces need to be reviewed, as there have been many changes in our downtown businesses. 1. There are no handicapped spots on the whole block of Merchant Street, but a number of great businesses for food. There should be one handicapped spot in the middle of the block on the east side of that street. 2. The first parking space on the south side of William at North Main Street should be handicapped so they don't have to cross a very busy street to get to any business in the whole block between William and Prairie. There are a number of great restaurants in that block. Trying to hurry across Route 51 from the parking lot on the east side of the street is not easy sometimes. 3. There is one handicap parking spot in the parking lot off of East Main Street, just south of Route 51, South Main corner, but it is about 4 spaces into the parking lot. Why isn't the first space the handicap spot? That is the spot which needs to be more accessible. Thank you for a review of this matter," she concluded in her letter to the city. Be interesting to see if we hear more about that. He continues on. The City of Decatur and City Manager Tim Gleason filed a motion last Thursday, okay, so it's a week ago, to have a lawsuit dismissed that was filed against them by fired Police Chief Brad Sweeney. In Sweeney's lawsuit, he is seeking reinstatement and punitive damages. One interesting twist in the motion to dismiss is that if Sweeney's allegations are true, that Gleason illegally used a police vehicle to transport him to a St. Louis airport in May because of a scheduling problem at Mayor Mike McElroy's suggestion, and Sweeney felt the action was illegal but allowed it, then Sweeney was not only participating in the offense, but did not arrest the city manager for breaking the law, end quote. Gleason contends that he had no knowledge that the police vehicle use was a problem or that Sweeney had an issue with it until after he was fired. There's a lot more in the motion that explains the side of the city of Decatur and the city manager. WSOY had the document posted on its website, and it is, to me, an interesting read. What the filing of the lawsuit by Sweeney and the subsequent motion to dismiss by the City of Decatur and Gleason have done so far is give the city manager an opportunity to explain his side of this story, something he couldn't do previously because it was a personnel matter. I don't know if the judge will deny the motion to dismiss, but even if the judge doesn't dismiss it, Gleason, due to the legal action against him in the city of Decatur, has been able to give some of his side of the story. Most of the time, unless a lawsuit is filed, people in positions like city manager are unable to respond publicly to allegations against them in personnel matters. We're continuing down the column. I was stopped in the drive-up lane of Dairy Queen the other day when the driver of the car in front of me, who was at the drive-up window, put his arm out of the window with a handful of scrap paper and dropped the paper on the driveway. It's probably a good thing that I was restrained by my seatbelt. When drivers throw papers and other refuse out their windows and onto the ground for someone else to clean up, I wonder how they were even smart enough to pass the driver's license test to drive a car. I know that to a lot of people, for me to be bothered by some drivers littering is a little over the top, considering big issues like world hunger, ISIS, etc. However, I think we first need to change the world where we are and improve our community. There are things that each one of us can do to make our community better, and they should be natural, no-brainer items, such as no dumping trash out of your car window. If you don't want your trash, what makes you think the rest of the community wants to look at it? I was going to get out and pick up his trash and put it in a trash barrel not very far away, but it blew all over the place and down the street. Probably this driver was one of those people who always complains about how the city looks. The sad part is that I believe many people who are trashers never give it a second thought. It's such a simple thing to do. Don't throw your trash out of your car window, that it is hard to believe that anyone would do it. Oh well, onward and upward to a greater Decatur, Illinois. We're out of time in the first half hour of news from the Decatur area for Thursday, March 3rd. We're going to take a quick break, and I hope you'll hang on, and we'll be back in just a few moments.